One day a father sent his son to learn about the secret of happiness from the wisest man in the world. The boy had to walk through the desert for 40 days and finally came upon a beautiful castle high atop a mountain. It was there that the wise man was living. But rather than finding a saintly man, our hero, on entering the main room of the castle, saw all sorts of activity. Tradesmen came and went. People were talking to each other in all corners of the room. The small orchestra was playing soft music, and there was a table covered with platters of the most delicious foods from all around the world. The wise man talked and mingled with everyone, and the boy had to wait for 2 hours before it was his turn to be given the man's attention. The wise man listened attentively to the boy's explanation of why he had come, but told him that he didn't have time just then to explain the secret of happiness. He suggested that the boy look around the palace and return in 2 hours. "Meanwhile, I want to ask you to do something," said the wise man, handing the boy a teaspoon that held 2 drops of oil. "As you walk around, carry this spoon with you without allowing the oil to spill." The boy began walking up and down the many stairways of the palace, keeping his eyes fixed on the spoon. After 2 hours, he returned to the room where the wise man was. "Well," asked the wise man, "how do you like my castle? Did you see the Persian tapestries that are hanging in my dining hall? Did you see the garden that it took the master gardener 10 years to create? Did you notice the beautiful shelves and rugs in my library?" The boy was embarrassed and confessed that he had observed nothing. His only concern had been not to spill the oil that the wise man had entrusted to him. "Then go back and observe the marvels of my world," said the wise man. "You cannot trust a man if you don't know his house." Relieved, the boy picked up the spoon and returned to his exploration of the palace, this time observing all of the works of art on the ceilings and the walls. He saw the gardens, the mountains all around him, the beauty of the flowers, and the taste with which everything had been selected. Upon returning to the wise man, he related in detail everything he had seen. "But where are the drops of oil I entrusted to you?" asked the wise man. Looking down at the spoon he held, the boy saw that the oil was gone. "Well, there is only one piece of advice I can give you," said the wisest of wise men. "The secret of happiness is to see all the marvels of the world and never to forget the drops of oil on the spoon. You see, no matter how far you travel and what wonders of the world you may explore, never forget who you are and where you come from. Never lose your character and stay true to your ethics, but at the same time look around you and focus on the world and people around you. The moral of the story is to open your eyes in life, but to never forget who you are and what is important. Thanks for watching, and stay blessed."
That's our story. Talk about. Now, can you guys hear me? Good. Okay, good. This is our story. This is what we're going to do all year. We're going to walk around with a teaspoon with 2 drops of oil, and we're going to watch what's going on in the craziest, most biggest expected year ever. But just think about all the expectations you have for what this year is going to be. And we're only in day 3, and we already have set it up to be some big, spectacular year. And we can forget about the oil. That's what we're going to talk about this year. Tim and I decided that for this year's teaching theme, we were going to talk about everyday Dhamma, or Dhamma showing up in everyday kinds of situations. So we're going to talk about wealth, the accumulation of wealth, about partners. I told Tim he should talk about sex. Somehow we need to throw sex in there because it's a big deal with the relationships, with emotions. And what about all this time? I'm going to talk about wealth this month, and I'm going to talk about technology next month. There's so much ordinary aspect of life that we as practitioners live in. And I think as urban practitioners, it's even more important that we talk about it this way, because much of our practice is based on a monastic model. And yet we live in a very urban world. And so Tim and I are going to spend some time. We have 12 subjects in 12 months, and we're going to talk about the more everydayness of practice and how do we hold both the oil, which would be our Dhamma, and then pay attention to the world we're living in and not have to choose between the two. But it feels like that sometimes. At least it did for me, and it does. I mean, I live Dhamma all day, every day now. But still, I can get caught up in worldly things and not pay attention. And when I was a trial lawyer, it was even harder. And so this is what this year is going to be about. How do we hold the spoon with the oil, which is our precious Dhamma, and still partake of the wonders of the world at the same time? We don't really have to have one or the other. And I thought that was a great story to set that in motion, to think about it a little bit. So a little bit about wealth. I'm going to start us out in talking just a little bit about maybe the framing of wealth a little bit. I'm talking just more general today, because next week is when I'm going to talk a little bit more poignant about it. But these are much shorter. These Sunday morning sits are much shorter talks, shorter guided meditation and shorter talks, so that you have an opportunity to have some time to talk and see what you're interested in around wealth. And this is the first time I've ever done it, but I actually want to give you some information. And then the thing I want you to talk about is what you're interested in about wealth, so we have an understanding of how to focus some of the talks over the month. But Buddha was not anti-wealth. I mean, when he came from money, so he knew he had the understanding of privilege. He came from, his father was a king, so he probably came from one of the most wealthiest people, families in the whole area he lived in. And he left all that wealth and went into poverty to live a more homeless life. But there's a way in which we in this Western world, culturally, the way we treat homelessness is a little different than the way homelessness was treated when in Buddha's lifetime. I mean, I'm sure they had some homeless people who were just homeless. But if you were homeless because you took up a holy life, you were treated with a greater degree of respect, and people took care of you. So there was not a kind of, you know, we treat homeless people like lost souls. And so if you see someone on the streets, you may or may not help them out. But holy beings were treated differently. And if you saw a holy being on the street, you were going to give him something. You were going to do something of generosity just for your own merit. So he knew, Buddha, as a monk, he knew the understanding of generosity. He knew this exchange that people gave to him to care after him. And he knew that sense of wanting to help a holy being on their path. So when he, you know, and in the suttas, there were many, many kings and many, many wealthy people who were patrons of the Buddha and his Sangha. They would, in a lot of Asian cultures, you go and you pay for the meals for all the nuns and all the monks and all the people coming to eat Dhamma for that meal. And it can get pretty, you know, it's not like here where you could give whatever. In some of these, like Thailand, you got to get on the waiting list just to be able to offer meal Dhamma to all the monks and nuns at the monastery. So it's not always, it's a big deal to pay and to give and to support this process. So wealth, being able to pay for all the meals, that can take a little bit of money. And so money is not the problem. Wealth is not the problem. What I think we're going to talk about, though, is how do you do this and maintain this sense of ethics, this sense of Dhamma? It's finding the Dhamma in the wealth. It's not the wealth itself. There's a sutta, but I couldn't find it this morning, so I'll find it for next week, where the Buddha actually said that it was important for people to acquire wealth, because he understood that if you acquired wealth, you could support the Dhamma at a level that someone who doesn't acquire wealth can support the Dhamma. So there's something about, as an urban practitioner, part of our practice is not folding away into the mountains and not doing anything, but to actually engage in the world such that you create wealth, such that you can support the continuation of the Dhamma. And so that's something I want to talk about next week. But anyway, this is what we're going to talk about all week. It's about prosperity. What does it look like when you have it, when you don't? Should you do it? I mean, people coming into the Dhamma always ask, should I give up my job? Should I just work at any old store? I mean, do I have to make money? Should I not make money? It feels like trying to make money goes against what the principles of the Dhamma is. And so we want to talk about that, so you can start this year off setting some goals for yourselves around money and not being afraid of it, not being afraid of money and the Dhamma. We hold a stickiness around money. But that stickiness doesn't have to show up around the Dhamma. That stickiness is in here. It's not in the relationship with the Dhamma. And so that's what I'm hoping by the end of the month, we'll feel more comfortable. We won't feel comfortable about the topic of money, because that is more in relation to your own issues. But I'm hoping that you'll feel comfortable enough to know that if you have an issue around money, it's not because it's in conflict with the Dhamma. It's because it's in conflict with your own mind. And so that's what I hope to, by the end of the month. At least that's what my thoughts are. So I want to put us in breakout groups so we can take 15 minutes to talk about what you'd like to know about money. What do you think about it? You don't have to say, oh, I got issues with money. You don't have to talk about money. That brings up way too much issue. So instead, just, what is it that you would like to know, like to talk about, or like to explore in the relationship with money that you could hear, that we could talk about? We have our own ideas of what we want to talk about, but I just want to double check and make sure that that's covering what you want to talk about also. All right, so we're in this big year setting up for looking at life and Dhamma, and we're going to start with the money. I mean, where else are you going to start at the beginning of the year? You got to start with money. So I want to give people who don't want to go into the small groups an opportunity to leave, because when I set the groups up, I want everybody to be okay in the groups that they're in. And I see.
Temporary. They could then come back after, because you'll be responding.
Oh yeah, you could if you want to do that.
So they can know that they can be admitted later.
Oh, if you don't want to go but you want to do the responding, just don't join. Just don't join the group. When you get the prompt to join the group, just don't join, and you'll just stay in the main hall. Oh no, don't do it like that, because I won't know. Okay, Cheryl, I got it. I won't know who's not going and who's, yeah, don't do that. You have to come back. I see only two people in there. So I want to put you in groups of three. And so I'm just going to, that's it. Everybody else is one. And if you want to say goodbye, you're free to do that. And I'm going to send everybody into rooms here while you're doing that. All right. So let's see if, let's see what things you guys would like to talk about over the course of this month, and money, and what's alive for us. I guess wealth is a little bit more than money. We're going to talk a little bit about that too, but yeah, go ahead, Charlotte.
Well, it came out for me that I have a feeling of lack of money from early in childhood, and it's not true. I don't lack for money. I'm doing okay, and so that's what I want to explore.
That's good.
Is what? How to heal that wound of lack?
That's good. You know, now you know it's going to take more than a couple of conversations. It's really going to take the practice of being with that discomfort, but. The talking about money is what helps us have the courage to be with that difficulty and begin to investigate it, because it is a mental thing, not a reality thing. So that's really good. I think we can talk about what is that feeling of lacking that comes around money. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
Hi, Query. This is Susan. I have to keep my video off. To what Charlotte said, this sense of lack that I've experienced in what I've become aware of through practice is it's there as a seed of a major defilement, the core defilement, a sense of lack, which permeates these parts of my life. So, I'm aware of that. I'm aware of how that connects to the worry mind or the defilements. So I can see that operating, but I'm still feeling kind of stuck in it. The other thing I notice is I'm just sharing like 3 points. The other point is that I wonder if we can see that wealth is a part of seeing the goodness of ourselves and, you know, kind of the wealth of our practice, that see the wholesome acts or our way of living, to see the goodness of this part of ourselves that we so often kind of undermine ourselves. And then the third thing is related to your examples of people in Asia who have perhaps, in my experience, less, but they have something. They do have wealth in the sense that they don't feel alone. They're in it together. People give each other food. They walk into each other's homes. And it's not these opposites that we have in our country, like privacy.
I see what you're saying, Susan. I'm just going to stop for a moment, because that's cultural. That's not necessarily Asian. That's in the Black community, the Jewish community, the Italian community. It doesn't really matter. That's more cultural. Just
right.
How you were raised, whether you were raised in a family where everybody brings something over to the rest of the crew. You know, that's that's more family cultural, the way we're socialized.
Right.
Which is a little different than this idea of I cannot see value. I can't see my own wealth or my own having. That's a little different. And I think if you think about it, that is what that story, that's what I wanted people to begin to think about in that story, right? Because there is, first of all, what Charlotte was saying about not having a sense of, having this sense of lack of money, even though I have money. And one way to think about it is to say, oh, that sense of lack of money is some trauma from my childhood that I need to get rid of. That's aversion, and that's antithesis to the practice. You will be trying to get rid of that for the rest of your life, and it's not going anywhere. So the opposite thinking in Dhamma is not to, also what you're suggesting is, well, what if I could see the wealth in my practice and begin to explore seeing this as being a good thing. So you're kind of like, ignoring the lack and putting my attention over here. That's all fine. But what I think the way to what I was trying to point to with that story is, we want to hold that lack and open our eyes to see abundance at the same time. You don't have to get rid of the lack of money. That's a family trait. I mean, I have trauma. So my mind, as soon as something happens, my mind is always going to say, oh my God, it's all over. This is it. This is the big one we've been waiting for. It's always going there. It's always stuck in trauma. I just don't listen to it anymore because I've seen enough to know that that is an automatic trauma mind response. I come from trauma people. So that response is a habit. It's not real. Mm-hmm. And I've seen both holding the oil and the tapestry at the same time. And it's kind of a balancing act here. So what you're trying, what we're trying to do is allow the pain of that childhood, there's not going to be enough, to be there and still be able to see and hold the truth that there is enough, that you don't have to pick between them, but you do have to be able to allow the pain that's associated with that childhood trauma. Do you see the difference that I'm talking about?
Oh, beautiful. Yes. Beautiful.
This is what I'm saying. We want to hold them both. And that's why I, out of all the things I listened to, that's why I wanted to pick that story. Because this is a good way to start the year, is that we're starting with, not that we have to replace anything, fix anything. This is what I'm going to work on all year so I'm a better person. It's not that. It is more what Charlotte's pointing to. And what you're pointing to, seeing the truth of this and holding this too, that it's and, not either or.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way we can hold it. Much better way to hold it that way. So everybody has both their problems with money, and they have, I mean, my sister, we grew up in a poor family. My father was very, very miserly about money. And my mother was, give it away. We don't have very much anyway, so let's give it away. Whatever. Anybody wants some money, let's share it all. So I was more like her. Like, give it away. Whatever. It's no big deal. My sister was more like my father, and she would never, I mean, that woman, yeah, just know that woman, that she could squeeze water out of a turnip. I know it. There's some water in there. She's not stopping it until she sees a drop or two. But the way we lived is what's remarkable, because both of us lived in poverty. So who was poor, her or me? Because even though you could say, well, she's got money in the bank, she never lived that way. She would hold on to a piece of clothing until it's fallen off, and she'd make her kids wear the other kids' clothes. I mean, she never would spend any money unless she went to the Goodwill. And yet I spent money all over the place. Neither one of us had any, but I don't know who was poor. I mean, I guess you could look at her and say, well, she's got money, but she don't live like that. So I don't know. Does she have money, not have money? So that's, this is more what it's looking like. It's like looking at the way we're being with it and holding both the oil, which is our practice to help us see, and then the world that we're looking at. Somehow see that. Does that make sense?
Beautiful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, Jean.
So two things come to mind. One is for, I grew up, you know, pretty, you know, from a relative point of view, privileged and not traumatized around money. But now we're on a fixed income and, you know, things are, we're not in difficulty, but it's puts a really different flavor. And this is,
I can see that.
And retired and, you know, on limited income for a while. And so how do you work with that, you know, being, wanting to be generous and so present situation and and then the other thing is really, I think what Charlotte was saying, the notion of scarcity as kind of a mentality that I think is, I feel it personally, but also on a kind of social, I think it's a driving force for a lot of what's going on in the world.
Yep.
And, you know, I think it would be interesting to have more discussion about, I don't know, I don't feel that powerful to make a shift, but how to recognize that that's sort of something we're swimming in too.
Oh, yes, you are. You guys are really getting in here because that scarcity mentality, it's funny. I have less money now than I had before. And I have more money now than I had before. I feel happier, freer, easier. And I have less money now than I had before. But even when I had money, I lived like I don't have no money. So I got to keep, you know, because I was spending it all the time. You know, it's like, I don't know how to describe it, but this is a thinking mind. This is grasping mind, habit mind thinking. This is not reality. And what you're talking about is scarcity is a mind thing. Abundance is a mind thing. It is not based on what you actually have. Yeah, Leslie.
Well, one of the things we talked about some good stuff in our little group. One of them was the distinction between people who have enough and people who don't have enough.
Mm-hmm.
And as myself as a food bank volunteer, every week I meet people who don't have enough to live even a life that can sustain health and continued life. They may not even have shelter in the dead of winter. People who really don't have enough in terms of the money to provide themselves with shelter and food and a place to cook and a place to, you know, running water. I mean, it's easy kind of to speak from a position of comfort about the relative nature of wealth. But if you are sleeping in a tent at 20 degrees, you know, there's something missing in your support system. So one thing I would suggest as a topic for you is that notion of relative wealth can include considerations about enough money to survive, so to speak. Another thing that we talked about was the relative nature of money, like the way we valued money and used money and considered money in youth as compared to the way we do when we're older and retired. Yeah. There's a difference there. If you're a consumer, then you're going to experience wealth in various, very different ways than if you tend not to be a consumer.
Yep.
If you're a person like myself, whose financial brain seems to have stopped in the 70s, everything seems really expensive and people are making outlandish amounts of money, you know, in their jobs, more money than I ever saw in my hard working life. Because the economy's moved on and I'm still back in the 70s. So there's that relative nature of money. Yeah. And so I guess that's kind of some of the things that came from our group.
There's one thing I want to point to here, and we have to be careful. Because this is about mind. This is not about places. Having grown up poor, and having lived in my car, I'm telling you, it's a state of mind, much of our poverty. I'm not saying that people don't have no means. I mean, I know that. But part of the problem of having no means is mental. It's partly a sense of, how do I say it? I don't know how to describe it, but I maybe over the course of my time next week, I'll talk about, you know, some of the food banks. I mean, I remember telling a story one time about going to the food bank, and I had one child at the time, and I didn't want him to feel bad about going to the food bank because it's such a miserable place to go to a food bank and get food. And so I kind of convinced him, dressed him up. He thought we were going to church someplace special. He got his church clothes on. He's looking good. He's feeling good. He's so happy. But I made him promise, you know, you got to be righteous here now because we're going, be very nice. People are going to give us stuff. So, you know, be appreciative, whatever we get, we're going to be happy. That boy was so excited by the time we got to that food bank that he went up and down the line because you stand in line. You know, you got to get there early and you stand in line. He went up and down the line, you know, oh, we're at the food bank. Are you here? Because he thought that you had to be special by not having any food. That was the only reason why we could go to the food bank. So we're in a special crowd here. So he's so happy to see everybody here because he thinks everybody's special. He had us cracking up in that line. By the time they opened the doors, I know they did not understand what is going on because we are laughing and talking. And usually you don't say nothing to nobody, but we are laughing and talking because he did not hold this as misery like the adults did. He held it as the special. And when he got in, he was thanking the people for everything. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. We're so happy. Thank you very much. All the way through. Man, they could not give us enough stuff to get us out of that place. So my point that I'm trying to make is I saw in him that if I held standing in that line in misery, it doesn't matter what anybody gave me. I'm still going to be miserable. And some of the problems with poverty is it is such a miserable state. That part of, there's a way in which we act like being joyous if you don't have anything, that's wrong. But it's not true. It's not true. I've been poor too long. So some of what I want to point to is just because people are very poor does not mean that they are not full of abundance. Full of it. They don't have to be. That having enough or not having enough, even for the very poor, is still a mental state. It is not necessarily a reality. Because how we hold money, whether you're very wealthy, you know, Trump doesn't have enough. He's always looking for some place to get some money. And I think he got a lot of money. So we may want to think that he don't, but I think he got a lot of money, a lot of access to money, a lot of access or stuff. And then I know people, they eat beans and rice. That's all they eat. That's all they got. But they are happy with the beans and rice too. So it's not the state. It's not necessarily your reality. It's the mental that we got to work on.
So I want to invite people to maybe put some of their topics in the chat. Because we only have 3 or 4 minutes left.
Oh, good thinking,
and
Susan.
So if you want to just do that, then we'll stay around after the group to write down the items from the chat.
Great. I'm so sorry. I should have said that. I wasn't even thinking.
That's okay.
I even actually have another
together,
meeting.
Together we do it.
So anyway, that I just wanted you to hear that. I did not want us to get stuck on this idea that some people don't have and there's no Dhamma available there because it is difficult. But
well, maybe the suggestion, Tori, if you're looking for suggestions for topics, is the difference between the ease or the challenge of listening to Dhamma when you're so hungry, you can't function, or you're so cold, you can barely move. And when those are not challenges in your life, maybe that's more to the point. Is
no, this is
the
what
Dhamma
I'm
is
saying.
Always available. I get that.
No, Leslie. I'm making a point here. So that's why I'm pushing back on you a little bit. You can be very cold and listen to the Dhamma. This, the Dhamma is not, it's in this Western mind that's used to convenience that we think you have to have a certain degree of convenience in order to practice. But it is not like that. It is a mind thing. When the mind is connected to Dhamma, it does not matter the conditions you're living in. It is not about the conditions. You can be very hungry. I'm sure many, many monks were very, very, very hungry, and they still practiced. They didn't steal, and they still stayed true to their Dhamma, their practice. I'm sure they were wet, tired. They had all kinds of crap going on for them, and they still practiced. So this is not about, we have to it's not a luxury to practice. That's what I'm trying to make. That's why I'm making a point about this. And I don't want us to leave with this idea that we only practice because we are in the conditions that make it conducive to practice. We practice because we have minds that are conducive to practice. But, and that's what we have to hold. That's what we have to rest, take refuge in. Because you can have money, convenience, still won't practice. Or you can have no money, no convenience, won't practice. And then vice versa. That's what I'm pushing on. Just this idea that you're not practicing because of the conveniences in your life. You are practicing because the Dhamma has called you in your heart. And that you want to stay connected to that no matter what happens. All right?
So we're going to welcome everybody back for the rest of this month. It's
yeah.
It's going to be a pretty, pretty interesting, not just this month, but the whole year as we really look at these issues that come up in daily life. And as the meditation leader, I'm a bit of a timekeeper as well.
Yeah, that's right. I'm so sorry. I just got
Terry,
so caught
you
in
have
that.
So much to share. So please do. I noticed that a lot of people wrote in the chat, and we'll keep Terry and I'll stay here and we'll make note of all the topics. So thanks everybody for being so engaged.
And yeah, thank you. I
really appreciate that.